So I want to dedicate our study today for the safety and well-being of all of our brethren in the Holy Land and everywhere in the world. It seems to be getting a little dicey out there. So Hashem should really protect our brothers, Achinu Kol Beis Yisrael, wherever they are. They should be protected from all danger. So I want to do two things today. I wanted to look at the Gemara and Shabbos. Pei Ches Amud Beis 88b, and it's the Gemara we looked at last time. I want to look at it again, and I kind of did a class on Wednesday that brought up this issue, this question, and just go through it. I wanted to expand a little bit by looking at some earlier Gemaras, and then the other thing I wanted to look at was more of a halachic thing, and that is that in the Shulchan Aruch, which is over here, it discusses the idea of a custom to spread out plants on Shavuot in the synagogue and houses. So what's the story with that? Do we is that a custom that we keep still, don't keep, and then we also have a custom to eat dairy food on the first day of Shavuot? Okay, so what's that about? Okay, so we'll get there. But first things first, let's look at this this Gemara. So the Gemara here says that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, when Moses ascended on high to receive the Torah, the ministering angels said before the Holy One, blessed be he, master of the universe, what is one born of woman doing here among us? The Holy One, blessed be he, said to them, he came to receive the Torah. The angel said before him, meaning God, the Torah is a hidden treasure that is concealed, that was concealed by you for 974 generations before the creation of the world, and you seek to give it to flesh and blood. As it stated about the idea of it proceeding such a long time, even before creation. So, just to skip ahead, God's answer was, the Holy One, blessed be he, said to Moses, provide them with an answer as to why the Torah should be given to the people. Moses said before him, master of the universe, I'm afraid lest they burn me with the breath of their mouths. God answered, grasp my throne of glory and provide them with an answer. And what did Moses say? So it says that he turns to God. It says, master of the universe, the Torah that you are giving me, what is written in it? I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt from the house of bondage. Moses said to the angels, did you descend to Egypt? Were you enslaved to Pharaoh? Why should the Torah be yours? Again, he asked the question, and they basically go through this whole rigmarole of what's written in the Torah, and the answers are all things that have to do with man and nothing to do with an angel. So the real question that pops out here, because we went through this, we talked about other things, but why don't the angels know this basic question? I mean, it's so simple. The Torah is clearly written for man. So what is going on here that they are so troubled by the fact that Moshe's coming there, a man of flesh and blood, for the Torah, if it's clear, it's like a no-brainer. Of course it's for the human being. So what's the story here? What's the Gemara telling us? Right? So is the takeaway that it's just that, yeah, the Torah is for human beings? Great, let's have a party and move on. It's very strange. So so first things first, what the Gemara is clearly saying, what the angels are telling us, or what the Gemara is trying to message us, is that the Torah is something that's so holy that it and so spiritual that it really belongs up in the heaven. And we saw another Gemara that talked about when Moses took down the Torah, that all of a sudden Satan was like saying, like, what do you mean the Torah is down in the earth? It doesn't have a place there. So the Gemara is like hitting that idea very hard. But the question is, what, the angels didn't understand this? That they didn't understand that it was geared specifically towards human beings. So the Shulchan Radvaz, I'm not sure exactly when he lived, but he asked this question as to what is going on here, meaning don't the angels understand? Didn't they have a version of the Torah? Couldn't they open it up and read these things? It's so basic. So he explains that the question, if you take a Torah scroll and you open it up, we notice two things. There are no vowels in the Torah. There are no tra. There's no cantillation. So why is that? Why, if we need the vowelization and the tra, the notes, to be able to both pronounce the words properly, and then also how you read a sentence is based on the notes. The notes are basically saying, you know, it's like the how does it go? Like, you know, the exactly how you read it, how you parse a sentence can change the meaning completely. So it's like grandma, you know, like what's that? They always have that joke, like grandma, don't eat grandma.
You're putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Okay, right, but what? So what is it? What's that? What's the famous one? Whatever it is, but you understand.
I have one.
Yeah.
What's that up in the road ahead? I knew you'd like that one. That's my favorite dad joke of all time. My family rolls their eyes at me all the time. I think it's hilarious.
Okay, right. So, but the point is that you don't have that. You don't know how you read a basic sentence, and we'll stop. The person who's reading the Torah, if they mispronounce words or if they stop in the wrong place, it literally changes the meaning. You have to ask them to repeat it and go and get it right, because it literally changes the meaning. So why, such a basic question, if it's so important, why would the Torah not be given to us? You take the Torah scroll out and it should have, give me the vowelization and give me the trup, which tells me where to start and stop and where to put the emphasis, and it really basically dictates what the meaning of how to read the sentence properly. So why not give us that? So the Radvaz explains that we need to understand that the Torah is actually, this book of letters, how we have it arranged, was not how the angels had it. That the angels had the same letters, but arranged completely differently. And therefore, they had a completely different Torah. And so, it's here you have this Gemara. It doesn't make sense that the angels don't have this basic idea, unless the answer is, they have a different Torah. Because what the Ramban Nachmani says at the beginning of his explanation in his commentary on Torah, he says the Torah is all, it's just the names of God. So, like, what does that mean? So what you're saying basically is that you could have this long text of letters that can be arranged completely differently. Same letters string, but grouped differently and have a completely different message. And that's exactly what the Radvaz says, is that the Torah, as it came to the angels, was a completely different structure than the one that we have.
Why would it be different?
Why would it be different?
Yeah.
Because it's complete. I guess the idea. Well, there are two things here. I think the underlying message is that the dynamic nature of Torah is such, because Torah is really something that is reflecting the endlessness of God. So God's communicating to man and to the world, and or he has even something that's the blueprint of creation, which he has imparted into the Torah. So it says that, for example, Estaka Baraisa Bara Alma, God looked into the Torah and created the world. Now, what does that mean? He looked into the Torah, and it says that Abraham was born, or that Abraham didn't say he was born. It says that he was commanded to go, to leave his homeland, and etc., all that story. Is that what God looked at when he looked at to create the Torah? Or is it that the Torah that we have has been parsed and changed, or not changed, but has been cured, so to speak, that when God takes this endless piece of literature or words and letters, and he arranges it to be able to communicate to us, but that before that, this Torah had it was even more dynamic and had more messaging going on. And even in this text that we have, we see that there's multiple layers of meaning in the Hebrew language, in letters and words that and how it operates. That on before that even, you had different arrangements of the same scroll, of the same book, that has different messaging and different ideas. And the idea of this incredible vastness of possibilities that exist in this Torah scroll, in terms of the letters that are there, that's an expression of the endlessness, or the incredible, you know, I guess, endlessness that God is. And so, I guess if you were to take the amount of letters and then talk about the permutations, etc., you're starting to get into this incredible, you know, vast, endless expression of what God is. So, like, for the best, I guess, example for us to be able to, like, get our heads around this is that when we talk about, like, the galaxies, and especially now science is finding that, you know, we're, like, you know, the universe and the galaxies, that's like, goes on and on and on, that we can, you know, start to get a sense of how, if that's just a little bit of an expression of God's endlessness, so we understand how vast and endless that is, that how do you express that in Torah? If Torah is the way it's explained a little bit, like you'll see it in the writings of the Tanya, the first Babacher Rebbe, the idea that God put himself into the Torah, so to speak, like, how, like, what does that mean exactly? But if we understand that this idea that the endlessness and the dynamic aspect of Torah, and that what we have and what's going on in this Gemara here is this idea that there was another version for the angels. The angels that are not physical had a different message in their Torah, same letters, different arrangement, and that's really what's happening here, is that God, as he brings it down closer to what to the point of where it comes to us, to man, is that that Torah is geared towards us, but he's now called it and fashioned it specifically to speak to us.
So the Torah that we have today, is it believed to be the same one that Moses had on Sinai?
So here's the question. So I just saw this last night. I was reading a very nice book written not too long ago by someone, and he was talking about, he brought down he explains there that when the Torah is given, this experience of the revelation at Sinai, that God gave over the Ten Commandments in one shot. He said all ten simultaneously, something that we can't, we're speaking here, right? Just tell you one idea at a time. But God, he actually delivered the Ten Commandments all in one shot. And it was like, whoa, okay. We didn't understand what we heard. Then we have a redo where it's now broken down as we have it recorded. But it says, like, for example, like, we have this in, you know, if you noticed in on Shabbos at, let me see if I can bring it up for you. When we're davening in the Kabbalah Shabbos, right? So, here, let me see if I can pull this up quickly. Let's see what I got here. Give me a second. It says that in Lechadodi, it says a line there. There we go. It says here, Shamor v'zachar b'dibor echad. Hishmianu el hamyuchad. Oh, it doesn't translate this? Come on. No translation. Nothing. How about that? So, but the idea is that he said this Shamor, like it says in the version we have in Yitro, right, in Exodus, it tells us that it's Zachor Yom HaShabbat B'Kadsho, right? It tells us that you're supposed to keep the Shabbos. It says Zachor, remember the Shabbos, and then this, in terms of in Vayetchanan in Deuteronomy, it tells us there, Shamor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. Right? So, which one is it? Is it that he said, remember, or keep? Which one is it? So, what it's saying in the, let me just pull this up for you so you see it.
Hey, Jonathan, can part of the two versions of the Torah, one for the angels or one before we get it, can that just be the fact that we couldn't possibly understand, like that there's a level that we couldn't possibly understand if it was given to us? Like we were too novice. Our understanding is not quite the same as angels or people on high.
So again, with the way this is reading out, I would say it's more that there were different versions. Meaning it's actually is it a lack of our understanding or ability to comprehend? Could be that, or it's that no, it's that it's also it's the way that Radvaz is telling us this is that the what we really have here is something that's so dynamic and let's put it this way, as the Torah comes to man, so it reads out the way we have it, and Hashem, you know, put it together the way we have it, and speaks to us. That's what the Talmud's telling us. But that there's another version, or that it reads out differently as you go further and further away from the physical reality. And then in the spiritual reality, there are different levels, because what Kabbalah is telling us is that, and struggles with in terms of understanding, is like, how do you go from the endlessness of God and the non-physical of being completely beyond, and then coming into this realm of where we're talking to each other right here? So that's where, like, there's like the Kabbalistic understanding is almost like a filtering system. It uses the analogy of light, right? That God is this incredibly bright light, and that it needs to be filtered down and down and down until it gets us down to this world. So now it's not literally a light, but there's something that's so vast and endless, and so as it comes into this world, it's being filtered into what we're experiencing here. The same thing with the Torah. That Hashem, the analogy that I saw, which I thought was beautiful, is that, you know, you have this brilliant person, a brilliant rabbi, who knows everything, and he's sitting there teaching a boy that's in second grade, you know? So he's going to teach this lesson, and he's going to really work hard to bring it down to the second grader's level. Now, we all know that this guy has, you know, he's a PhD equivalent or greater in Torah knowledge, but he literally is like curtailing it down to this second grader so he can understand and get the understanding of a concept that, you know, as you get older, you'll expand it, right? So there's the same idea that God is doing for us, is that whatever the knowledge base of the endlessness that there is, he's taking it down, and the Torah is an expression of that as well, meaning the way it's brought down. And even in the Torah, for us, we see that there's so many levels of understanding, even in this, in the structure it is. But the Radvaz is saying, based on this Gemara, it's a pretty unbelievable thing. But it's also, I think, what he's really expressing is what Nachmanides is saying in his beginning of when he talks about, like how we understand the five books of Moses, that this idea of the arrangement of letters, that the letters are like the base. And that's what God looked at, that there's something that whatever, that's like the blueprints of, as you're about to begin to build something, that blueprint has a different, you know, it's more abstract, right? So in a sense, there's a certain abstraction that is expressed and is still in these letters. The same letters that we have are in the abstract realm as well, that the angels had, and it has different messages, right? So it's actually also, if you think about it, it's really also, the beauty of it is that it's able to address the different realms as it goes through, right? So as we go from, in the Kabbalistic ideas of Keter, which is like the crown, which is beyond our comprehension, into wisdom, into understanding, and as it comes into this realm of that we are in, that it's filtered down, and it's curtailed to be able to speak to us. You know, and in each realm, the beauty of it is it has the ability to address the different levels. So you see here that, right? Here you have, in the first accounting, which is what we're going to read tomorrow morning, we're going to read the Ten Commandments, and in there it says, remember the Sabbath day. When Moses tells it over, it says, observe the Sabbath day. Same Ten Commandments. Well, that would be fun to just, like, you take the two versions of the Ten Commandments, right? So here, Hashem, when he comes and gives us over the Ten Commandments at Sinai, he's, again, beyond our ability to even, like, understand. And what they heard, maybe it was just like, it's like you're hearing it, and it's like, I can't believe what I just heard. Because you can't believe it, because it's impossible to comprehend. And therefore, you have to then go back and break it down and say it one by one, the way we communicate. Like, one of the, you know, in the text, it says, they saw the calls, they saw the sounds. How does that work? So there's all this stuff that's happening in terms of this experience, this, you know, cataclysmic, I don't know, it's like, it's a really just a wild event that occurs there. But the idea is that you have, you know, you asked about what is, did Moshe get the Torah the way we have it? So it's possible. I you know, I've heard there are different understandings as to how it all played out. So, meaning, did Moshe come down with, like, you know, he's got the Ten Commandments in one arm, and he's got his five books of Moses in the other arm? Is that how it happened? So, now understanding what the Radvaz is saying, it could be that Moshe got the Ten Commandments, no problem, but also might have been given the Torah with all of its letters, just not arranged to the point of where it made sense completely. And then over the 40 years of the Midbar, of the desert, that it became clarified. The same way that the initial telling of the Ten Commandments was in a way that we couldn't comprehend, only for it to be reviewed and broken down one by one. So perhaps that's, you know, this is an approach that can make sense of it. I mean, the other understanding is that no, that when he got the Ten Commandments, and then over the 40 years, he got, you know, section by section by section of this Torah. You know, exactly. So that's in every beautiful thing, there's different opinions as to how we understand it.
What about the 40 days between Shavuot or the days? Because, right, there's also that we got the Torah on Yom Kippur, correct?
Well, okay, so let's talk. Let's talk about that for a second, just to keep it clear.
Wait. No, we got it.
No, we got the Torah at Sinai, but we also got the Torah on Yom Kippur.
Right. So what happened? Let's talk about. So Moses is up there. He goes up now on Shavuos. We have this incredible event called the Revelation, and then he's up there for 39 days, or 40 days, or he's up there. And what's going on for 40 days and 40 nights is God's transmitting to him the Torah, and all of the, you know, oral tradition as well. It's all being given over at that point. But then there's something goes wrong, and we have the sin of the golden calf. Moses hears about it, comes down, and breaks the luchot. He breaks the tablets. At that point, it's not a good situation. Moshe has to. He's already starts, and he's in the middle of, like, basically saving the Jewish people.
Jonathan, is it agreed that the tablets contain the Ten Commandments, or? Is there disagreement or agreement on what is on those tablets that he breaks?
So it definitely has the Ten Commandments. The question
is, anything else?
That's the question. Is there more on this or not? It's not. It's the nature of the first Ten Commandments are completely God made, right? Everything from beginning to end.
Right, and then there's talk about how the circle and the O is standing there, and it stands by itself, and you can see through it, and all this other stuff, right?
Right. So there's a lot. There's something very. It's a different level than the second set,
okay.
Because the second set. So exactly what's on it could, like, there are different, you know, again, different opinions, but I would say that the answer is that you're talking about something that has. So that, but again, that first one has the Ten Commandments at least, and maybe the whole Torah and everything, all in there. You know, so
okay.
Like in years past, like say 50 years ago, 100 years ago, if I told you that you could store all of the information of endlessness of Torah that exists today on a single tablet, you tell me you're crazy, right? Today you'd be like, oh yeah, sure. You got a terabyte of storage.
I got my drive. I got my flash.
So it's interesting, right, is that in the Yerushalmi, which was written, you know, at least it's gone back almost, I would say, at least 1,000 years, there's a description of data being stored on waves so that you could actually have all this data sitting in one on one thing. You know, so like, it's amazing that they were describing something today. We're like, yeah, of course, you know, no problem. It's all in here. You see, it's right here. It's on the, you know, I got it on the phone. I mean,
let me ask something else. So the Torah we have today, it should be such that if I take a Torah from here in New York, and I compare it to a Torah that exists today, say in Yemen or Iraq, they're
going to
be the same.
So the answer is they're pretty much the same. I mean, almost exactly. I think they found, the answer is they're almost exactly accurate. I mean, like, the point of where I'm talking, like, maybe there's like one or two variances of that. It's amazing. That's, I was just thinking about it the other day.
Let's look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. They say the Dead Sea Scrolls matches almost exactly. These are things that haven't been touched for thousands of years. Yeah. It matches almost exactly the current day Torah.
Correct. It's pretty amazing. It's really, like, you think about it. It's without any, you know, it's really incredible. Okay, so now. Just to summarize, so what the different approach of on this Gemara that we just said is that the question that what if the angels don't know? And the answer is that they had a different version, but it's also expressing the incredible, you know, now that taking this approach, the Torah as we have it is addressing us, but also has this unbelievable vast, you know, possibilities of different understandings, and that it's when you're taking something that's coming from the completely spiritual realm into the physical realm, it's going to have this shift in a sense, which is pretty unbelievable. And that how you express that concept or that idea is the fact that there are no vowelizations and none of the tune of how you read a sentence. It's not in the scroll itself, because that needs to be open-ended, because to be able to express this idea. Okay, so that's idea number one. Now, so we have a tradition of two things here. So let's see what the Shulchan Aruch, right? So the Shulchan Aruch was written by Rav Yosef Cairo at the end of the 1400s, early 1500s, he lived in Sfat. That is he wrote four sections. One that gets the most of our attention today is the Aruch Chaim, is the things that talk to the subject matters of Shabbos, daily practices, the tefillin, the tzitzis, the talis. It also talks about the different holidays, it talks about Shabbos, about all the different laws that pertain to these things, the daily things. So in here, he talks about the idea of Shavuos. Okay, so he talked about the Omer, and then gets us to here. So on the 50th day of the count for the Omer is the holiday of Shavuot. The prayer service is like the holiday of Passover. Rather, we say the holiday of Shavuot, the time of the giving of the Torah, of our Torah. We say a full hallow. We take out two Torah scrolls and read the first one, the five sections of the third month until the end of the order. The Maftar is read in the second scroll on the day of the first fruits. As the Haftarah, we read the chariot of Ezekiel and the end of the verse, and the wind took me up, which is interesting, the whole idea of revelation. We also say, we bring it from the revelation that Ezekiel had, which is a vision of the chariot. Fine. And then it talks about the second day. This only applies here, as opposed to Israel. Okay, now. It says you're not allowed to fast after the holiday. And then the Ramah. So now the Ramah, Rav Moshe Israelish, was of Ashkenaz, living in Europe. And he wrote a Shulchan Aruch as well. He wrote a book of laws that actually was parallel to the Shulchan Aruch. So here you have Rav Yosef Cairo of Sephardic descent. He's living in the land of Israel. And you have Moshe Israelish also writing a similar type of book living in Europe, okay, of Ashkenazic background. Now, how is it possible, they're living in different places, that they would actually have the same format? The answer is that there was a book of this order, of the Shulchan Aruch, that actually preceded both of them, called the Torah. The Torah is coming from, you had someone else that already had put this order together in terms of codification of law. So Maimonides wrote his classic work of Yad HaChazaka that also started putting all the laws together. But you also had, from the Bali Tosos, so you had, in, let's say, the 12, 1300s, you had them starting to take the Gemara, the Talmud, and started in the back, taking and trying to figure out the codification of law based on the Talmud. And it came into structure known as the Torah. And then from the Torah, you have Rav Yosef Cairo taking and creating the Shulchan Aruch, and Rav Moshe Isserles, who's sitting in a faraway land, doing the same thing. When Rav Moshe Isserles realized that Rav Yosef Cairo was doing what he was doing, and he had already written his book, what he did is, instead of writing his own separate book, he integrated it together. So that what you have here is the two integrated, so that when we take out our Shulchan Aruch today, we have Rav Yosef Cairo, and then you have Rav Moshe Isserles, like, on the same, he inserted himself into the Shulchan Aruch, so you have them both on the same, in the same place. And then from there, you have commentaries. So when I take the book off the shelf, I'll have like multiple commentaries that are going to start with them. And then from there, you have the later commentators like adding on. So through the 1500s, the 1600s, 1700s, it's all adding to this work called the Shulchan Aruch that we pull off our shelf. Happens to be one of the more popular books today that we take off the shelf is a Mishneh Berurah. Right, so we know this, the author of the Mishneh Berurah, better known as the Chavetz Chaim. So Chavetz Chaim lived until he passed away in 1933, and he lived in Europe. He wrote, his famous book was about the laws of Lashon Hara, right? So that's pretty well known, Chavetz Chaim. He also wrote a commentary on, called the Mishneh Berurah, on the first book. There are four things, but on the Or HaChaim, he wrote a whole commentary called the Mishneh Berurah, okay? And so there, he has, you know, a lot of the law that we have today that will go in and say, okay, what does the Shulchan Aruch say, Ramah? And then you'll have the Mishneh Berurah on the bottom, giving us even more and more information as to understanding how we practice these things. Okay, so let's see here. I'll show you inside here. So, Rama says, and we do not say Tachnun from the beginning of Rosh Chodesh Sivan until the eighth day, which is after the post-holiday day. We have the custom to spread out plants on Shavuot in the synagogue and in houses as a memory of, for the happiness of the receiving of the Torah. Okay, so let's just see that again. We have a custom to spread out plants on Shavuot in the synagogue, in houses as a memory for the happiness of receiving the Torah. Okay, we have to figure that out. We have a custom everywhere to eat dairy food on the first day of Shavuot. And it seems to be that the reason is like the two foods that are taken on the evening of Pesach, a reminder of the Karban Pesach and a reminder of the Karban Chagiga. So too we eat dairy food followed by a meat food. And we bring with them two loaves on the table in place of the Mizbeach, of the altar. And thus there will be a reminder of the two loaves that were brought on the day of the Bikurim. So we bring this Shtei Lechem. What's unique to the holiday of Shavuot in terms of its sacrifices is that you bring the two breads. So you go from the beginning, Pesach, we brought in Omer, which is a barley offering. And when we get to Shavuot, we bring the two loaves of leavened bread. Okay, and he's saying here that the idea of eating milk on Shavuot is to show that we should have two types of food, one of meat and one of milk. And that's going to remind us of the two breads, the two bikurim, that were brought on Shavuot. Pretty interesting. Because if you ask someone, why do you have milk on Shavuot, I don't think you're getting that answer from people. What they'll tell you is, the Torah is like milk. That Moses was like the mother, and he gave us the Torah is like the milk of a mother's milk.
Yeah.
You don't like that?
No.
You never heard that one?
I've never heard it, but I don't like it.
You don't like it? Another one was that when God the laws of kashrut, everybody didn't have the proper things. We hardly couldn't eat milk on that day. I don't know. So here we're saying it's nothing to do with that stuff. Okay, fine. So we have two things we got to figure out here. Why is it that we have this custom to have greenery in our homes and in our shuls on Shavuot? Okay, so let's see if we can pull that up here. Okay, so now you see I tapped on this, the beautiful thing, that's Faria. He brings us the Mishnah Berurah. Boom. Okay, so here he says, in the remembrance of the joy of receiving the Torah, for there were grasses around Mount Sinai. So this is not, we didn't get this from the Ramah. Now comes along the Mishnah Berurah, our the Chavetz Chaim, right? And he says, in remembrance of the joy of receiving the Torah, for there were grasses around Mount Sinai. It says, the flocks and cattle shall not graze. Meaning that there was something to graze. That's what we understand. It's kind of like a side point we are able to understand. That there actually was a lot of grass around the mountain, miraculously. Remember, they're in their desert. But now this, at the time of Mount Sinai, when the revelation happened, all of a sudden it became filled with greenery. So latter sages wrote that in places where it is the custom to give out fragrant grasses in the synagogue, they should not give them out from Baruch Shamar until after the Amidah, so that one may bless over them. The blessing of, you know, when you smell something good, you're going to say, Bari minem samim, or Bari minem asavim. When you smell something good, before you smell it, you make a bracha. Because, so they said, wait till later in the service, because during that period, it's forbidden to interrupt the prayer. There is a custom to stand trees in the synagogues and homes in remembrance that on Shavuot, judgment takes place for the fruits of the tree. Completely different thing. Nothing to do with Mount Sinai, but rather, that if you look in Rosh Hashanah, there's an idea that there are different times of the year when things are judged. Come Shavuot, it's the time when we get judged on the fruit of the tree. So therefore, we would have trees as remembering that aspect of the day. Comes along the Vilna Gaon, the Gra abolished this custom, because now it is the ritual of the non-Jewish nations to put trees in on their holiday. So he said, scrap that custom, no trees in the shul, okay? Now, on this one, so there are two things that are going on. Either it's a remembrance of the fact that there was greenery around Mount Sinai, or number two, we're saying it's because of the idea that the trees, the fruit of the tree, are being judged. Okay, so there's two separate things, and then comes along the Vilna Gaon. He's like, we're not happy with this custom. So now, on that,
Jonathan, I just have a quick question for you. The custom of eating dairy and then meat, is that in the same evening?
So let's go there. We won't focus on the Vilna Gaon thing, whether or not we, because if today custom in my shul and many shuls is to have beautiful flower arrangements in the front in order to for special for Shavuot, right? So there is this idea of bringing flowers and plants into the shul. To remind us, it sounds like it's more the driver of the fact that they had the greenery around Mount Sinai. Okay, so now, in many places to eat, and in regards to whether it's permissible to dairy food.
Well, I'm just wondering, because you have dairy and meat. There's obviously a waiting period between the two. You can't eat milk with meat, so how does that function? So eat dairy, then wait an hour, and then.
Oh, so how would you do it? Okay, so the easy thing is to eat dairy. And then have meat, if that's what you're... Because, again, there is this idea that you have to have meat on a holiday. That in order to celebrate a holiday properly, you're supposed to have meat. So then you would eat you'd have dairy, and then you could
You have blintzes, you wait an hour, and then
Okay, so let's talk about that. You don't even have to wait that long. After eating dairy, unless you have some kind of very specific hard cheeses, you don't have to wait. So you just have to wash your mouth out with drink something, maybe have a little bit of bread. Boom, you can go right into the meat if that was the way you wanted to play, okay? Now, but let's see this. Let's see this reasoning for the dairy, okay? So he says like this, Silamak and Avram, and I also heard in the name of a Gadol who said a correct reason for this, that when Bnei Yisrael, when the Jewish people stood at Har Sinai and accepted the Torah, when the Ten Commandments were revealed, and through this all parts of the Torah were also revealed to them, like the Rav Tzad Yigon writes, that the Ten Commandments sustained the whole Torah. Okay, another interesting idea. And they went down from the mountain to their homes. They found nothing to eat immediately except for dairy foods, because for meat, they would need to much preparation to slaughter with a checked knife like Hashem commanded. Right here they go. And Hashem says, okay, guys, now you want to eat meat, you're going to have to do shechita. You have to do it. It's a whole long to do. So they're like, wait a second. The only thing we have, the only option we have now is to have dairy. And so that's what happened. That became, you know, the net was that they couldn't have, right? Because the idea is then to clean out the strings of forbidden fats and blood and to rinse the salt and rinse and salt the meat. And also to cook in new vessels, because their previous vessels had been used to cook meat. And they now discovered it was actually treif, right? It wasn't kosher. They had to wait at least 24 hours, which is, okay, so their old vessels were forbidden to them. Therefore, they chose to, on account of the time, to eat dairy foods. So therefore, we do this as a commemoration, okay? So like a practical outgrowth of getting new laws of dietary restriction, right? Now all of a sudden, meat preparation is going to be taken on a whole different, totally different thing. So, okay, only, you know, the easy answer here for our time being is to just have milk. Another one is, in some places, there's also custom to eat honey and milk, because the Torah is likened to them, as it says, honey and milk under your tongue. Okay?
So tonight, you only eat dairy, and you do not eat meat. It's a dairy meal.
So it is a dairy meal. We'll have fish. We'll have fish, because the idea is, you know, either meat or fish is a way of elevating the nature of the celebration, right? Though you should have wine, right? So you have wine, meat. It's interesting, because what we're saying is there's this idea of simcha, this idea of having joy. One should have joy when it comes to the holidays. One should have joy also on the Shabbos, but there's a special idea of joy infused into the three big holidays, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. So when we celebrate it, so the Ramban, Maimonides, when he talks about, there's no, like the Gemara talks about the idea of simcha, there's no joy except for with having meat and wine. But what that means is that in order for us to, like, you know, the idea of to be in a celebratory state of being when it comes to food, so it was, the tradition is that of having meat and wine. So, And the meat is really a derivation from the idea of the sacrifices. You'd bring a shlamim, you bring a karbon, a sacrifice, and part of that, the process of that, like the karbon Pesach, the Paschal sacrifice, is that part of the worship was eating. It's funny, like here we're saying, you think of spirituality is nothing to do with physicality, and we're saying, no, you can actually elevate the physical, and that's part of the spiritual process. Is taking something and eating it within the process of the sacrifice. That's part of what makes the sacrifice how to actualize the avodah, the work there that's been asked of us, is to eat, right? So we elevate our eating. We say that you can eat, if you eat it for the right reason, you can elevate it to make it a spiritual event. So that's part. So it was the idea of that and wine. We understand wine has definitely makes us feel good and happy, and so the idea of wine and meat as part of that. So then one of the things that we see, like let's say there is an extension to the idea of having fish, that also fish, dagim, is also, you know, elevates and brings, you know, that kind of joy. Although, again, the basic is meat and wine, which is kind of funny. So the idea of, like, that's why people have this, you know, so here you have a driver of milk. We see that there's something about Shavuot and association of milk, hence the extension of that is cheesecake, you know. That's another, like, extension into, like, the holiday, like, associations of what people eat because of this idea of milk. But also people say, okay, I'll have some milk. I'll have that, whatever it is. And then I'll take a break and have some meat because I want to fulfill that obligation. Now, again, if it's just, like, ridiculously too much, so that's also a problem. So, like, everything within measure. So like tonight, they'll probably be just, it's just a, you know, like people have milk and fish, or there are other people that will say, no, you know what? My custom is to just have meat and wine like I do on any other holiday, because that's how we, you know, celebrate. Then, you know, again, it could be that you'll have people say, you know, I hear that, but you know, what makes me happy is having vegan, you know, or vegetarian. So, you know, that it's all out there. But here you see that the, what they're saying is this, there's the, we see here this idea of our custom. What's interesting here, this latter part of what the Rama is bringing down, which is really not as, you know, is what you don't hear as much, but he's saying here, then here's the Mishneh Berurah of it. What this means to say is that on Passover, we make a remembrance of the Karban Passover, right, on the Seder plate with the bone. Thus, we do on Shavuot, when we remember the Shtei HaLechem that was brought. And therefore, we eat a dairy meal, and afterwards we eat a meat meal, and we need to bring with the meal two different breads, because it is forbidden to eat milk and meat from the same bread, and this serves our remembrance. He's saying that he's giving a little bit more of it. It didn't make sense. When we saw the Rama, it didn't, like, I don't understand. Milk, meat, breads, how does that have to do with two breads? But he's saying when you do that, if you have a milk and meat bread, meals, you're going to have separate breads. So what, in a sense, what he's saying is, I really, what I want to remember is the two breads. So how do I remember them? I'll eat milk and meat. That forces me to have two separate breads, and boom, I've fulfilled that obligation. Because with this idea of the Shtei Lechem, so it's right. It's a very it's a standout. It's very unique. Now, what's interesting, what I saw last night is that normally we have on holidays, we always have a sacrifice that is a sin offering. There's a sin offering part of the whole day's, you know, let's say, like a readout. It's a readout of like all the different sacrifices that are brought. Usually in there, you'll have one of the things that's brought is a sin offering. Shavuot, no sin offering. Why is there no sin offering? I mean, why is this different than any other Manish Dana? Why is this different than all other, you know, holidays? And the answer that I saw is that when we got the Torah, there's something about the power of the Torah that is able to wipe our slate clean. Like it has this redemptive type of power. So that therefore, whereas normally we'd need to bring a sin offering because we're all human and we mess up, something about Shavuot and the power of Torah that has the ability to bring us atonement without having to bring the sin offering. It's pretty unbelievable, right? So this idea that here is a holiday within the readout of the different sacrifices they brought, they did not bring a sin offering because it was not required, because something about Torah has that ability to be redemptive. All right, so it's interesting to see this idea of the different drivers behind why we'd have this custom to have greenery and flowers in our houses and shul. And then the second thing about this idea, the custom of having milk and not meat. So here at least we have this readout of perhaps it's because they, when they got back, they didn't have the ability of time to prepare meat, so they end up just going with the milk. Or this idea of the Torah is compared to milk and honey under the tongue, so we'll have milk. Or this idea of remembering the Shtei Lechem, the two breads that were brought as the sacrifice for, that was connected to the Bikurim, the Shavuos special offering, and that will be the drive to how to remember that, is to have two breads, one for the milk, one for the meat, but you have to always have separate. By the way, just as a side, he mentions here that in general, we try not to make our bread from milk, so that you're not going to have milk in bread. If you find dairy bread, a lot of times you won't find a kosher symbol on it. Like that, I don't know if you ever heard that, but because most of our, like the idea that we have most of our meals with bread, like in terms of like, let's say Shabbos, you're not going to have, you can have meat and your chicken on the table. You don't want to have milk and bread. So the challah, you'll never find the challah that's been made from milk. That's like unheard of. Think about it, right? You'll look around for it in the future. You'll never find a kosher challah that has milk.
Jonathan, not to take this in a different place, but I do have one quick question in reading the translation, and maybe the translation's a little different than the Hebrew.
Okay.
But it says, we have the custom to spread out plants on Shavuot in the synagogue and in houses.
Mm-hmm.
You're going too far. Back up a little bit. I need the English. Thank you. Do we have the customer spread out plants in...
I'm sorry. That was me being bad.
We have the custom to spread out plants of Shavuot in the synagogue and in houses as a memory fabric. And then we have a custom everywhere to eat dairy food on the first day of Shavuot. Why is it specifically saying, and maybe I'm just reading into it, but why is it specifically saying synagogue and houses, and then in the other thing it says everywhere? I just know, it just seems to me odd that one would say specifically and then would say everywhere, or am I just reading something into it that has no bearing on anything?
No, so I did notice that. It is interesting, but I guess, you know, I don't know what the other places you would be able to put your, you know, greenery besides the, you know, like, meaning, it says, right, you said the greenery is in the shuls and in the houses. Whereas when it comes to the eating of the milk, it's everywhere, right? So it's kind of a funny thing, but I don't know. Maybe because of restaurants, I don't know. You know, hotels.
It's funny that the wording, and yeah, we say so many times that nuances in wording.
Yeah,
so
and no, I noticed it. I'm like, I don't know if you make any special. Inference there. Is there anybody that says anything here? Yeah, I don't see. I don't really see anybody making any inference from that. I did notice it, so it's good. I'm happy to see that you're a critical reader, which is good. It's good to see. it's good to be a critical reader. Yeah. So that's.
Well, I just find that so many times when we're studying things, how a word is spelled or how a word is said, just as you said earlier in the class, can change an entire meaning. I was just wondering if that had anything to do with it.
No, so it's a good critical reading, and I'm not, you know, doesn't really, I mean, I guess like you're saying, it's in more than just, it's not limited to those two places. When it comes to where we eat milk, you know, that custom, it's everywhere, as opposed to limited to the shul or to the home. Yeah.
So to bring it back to what you had said earlier. So it's funny, you know, you were talking about the different realms and how the light is filtered as it comes down to us, or the Torah is filtered down, comes down to us. And you mentioned Perkei Avos, and I was thinking about, you know, how, you know, I studied Perkei Avos for the first time 4 years ago. And we studied Perkei Avos the other night, Thursday night, and how I perceived the piece of Perkei Avos we studied on Thursday differently than I did from 4 years ago. I'm in a very different place spiritually and learning-wise, and it meant something very different to me. And just as I'm in a different place, as I'm in a different level of learning,
mm-hmm.
The Torah can have different meanings and different levels. You know, I feel like, you know, because you said something that struck me, the Torah is living. And it lives for me in a very different way than it lives for you, and it lives for you because of where we're at within our lives and what we need from the Torah at that particular time in our lives. So maybe the perception of how it's looked at because of where we are on the ladder can be different. So it could actually be the same Torah. But the angels look at it very differently because of where they are, and mean differently because of where we are.
Right. So the answer, there are two things. One is yes, that it's true. But at the same time, in this case, because it's so geared towards human beings as opposed to angels, so that's where the Radvaz is going and saying, it must have been a different version. Meaning but even with that said, the nature of the Torah that we have, that we're reading, has the same dynamic aspect to it, like you're talking about. That meaning, we read it together, we learn it together, you're learning it, you hear something, I hear something, you know, everybody else, each person gets their own, they're hearing, you know, they're relating to things differently based on where they're at. And that as time goes on, they're able to cull and get different ideas and understandings all from the same Torah. And so it has that dynamic aspect to it in its text that we have. But the idea that he was saying is that it's even bigger than that, because it has this idea of the non-vowelization opened, you know, to the idea of the arranging of the letters in such a way that it's going to even be messaging in a completely spiritual realms of angels that are different than what we're hearing in our realm. And that it has this, but it's also, he's saying that the Torah is, again, it's to be a book that's going to reflect the aspect, like God's endlessness. It's going to be something that's, you're talking about, it has to have that, you know, really an open-ended type of dynamic aspect to it that's really unique. It's a very, you know, it's more Kabbalistic in nature. I don't know if I went to the Rambam and I asked him or said, like, presented him the idea of the Radvaz, you know, I'd have to look to see if Maimonides addresses it in this way. I don't know. I'm not sure. This is definitely more of a Kabbalistic approach. Not to say that, again, Maimonides wouldn't go for it. I don't know. I have to look a little bit more. Like, I just saw this Radvaz, so if there's something in the Rambam, Maimonides' writings, that would give us a hint that maybe he saw this as well. I don't know. I'm not sure.
And is this sort of the, it's related back to, remember a couple of years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago, there was a thing about these codes, the hidden codes in the Torah?
Exactly. So I was waiting for
Torah. Is that still held as something that's, like, legit, or people have, like, that was just...
So the answer is, I'll tell you like this. For me, my approach is, I think it's really interesting. I don't hang my hat on belief in any of it as being... That's not the basis of my understanding of, like, why I would be a believer of the Torah coming from Sinai, and that it's, you know, God, you know, is the, it's all derived from Hashem. That I don't need that to tell me that. I just need to... All I do is I learn Torah, and I every time I learn more and more, I'm more and more convinced that there's no way that any human being was behind this. It's impossible. It's so the depth of Torah, and it's so dynamic, and it's impossible. And like I was joking around with someone, like if you learn just the laws of by leprosy and the intricacies there, no one, it's just, it, you know, and then there are other examples of just no human being is coming up with this. Just not, you know, so I don't need someone to tell me that the, you know, and they counted this, you know, the patterns and the, you know, and it, you know, I think it's fantastic. If it excites people, great, but it shouldn't be the place that they should, you know, hang their hat on that, and that's the, you know, enough for them. I think that's cheapening the incredible depth of what Torah is. It's amazing. The more you delve in, and the more you hafochba, like dig there and dig there, the more you're going to find. It's like, and it's just, it's so amazing. And that's the holiday we're celebrating this tonight and tomorrow and the next day. All right?
Thank you.
All right.
Have a wonderful holiday.
Enjoy your Shavuos. Have a great Shavuos.
Should be filled with joy. That's what we need. We need a lot of joy. All right?
Okay.
Thanks, Captain.
Okay. Bye-bye.